This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, an update on Russia's invasion of Ukraine, the resilience of Ukraine in the face of the unprovoked attack on February 24th by Russian President Vladimir Putin's forces on the ground and in the air, the unified response by the West providing defensive weapons to Ukraine and imposing punishing sanctions against Moscow, the significance of Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky's courage and leadership, and the refugee crisis spawned by the unprovoked attack. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. It has been almost 1 month since the Kremlin launched a senseless war on neighboring Ukraine, a continuation of its illegal annexation of Crimea in 2014, and destabilization of the southeastern Donbas region. Vladimir Putin's original plan to quickly subdue the country with his more than 100,000 troops and appeal to the Russian-speaking population, especially in the east, has failed miserably in the face of Ukrainian resistance and resilience. However, analysts say this turn of events has forced Putin to resort to the savage tactics he used in Grozny in Chechnya and in Aleppo, Syria, where he targeted civilians and civilian infrastructure to effectively bomb the population into submission. Ukrainian officials have accused Russia of bombing a theater in Mariupol, where hundreds of displaced families have taken refuge, according to the Washington Post. These tactics, which White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki has called, quote, barbaric, have prompted U.S. President Joe Biden to call Putin a war criminal. In his address to the U.S. Congress this week, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky requested more defensive weapons and a no-fly zone to be imposed over the skies of Ukraine. While a no-fly zone is opposed by NATO because it could provoke confrontation between two nuclear powers, President Biden announced a new $800 million aid package, including a range of weapons such as 800 anti-aircraft systems. The White House announced that President Biden will head to Brussels next week to coordinate deterrence and defense efforts with NATO. For more on the crisis and how to bring the conflict to an end, we turn to two distinguished experts. Andrea Kendall-Taylor is Senior Fellow and Director of the Transatlantic Security Program at the Center for a New American Security, a policy group based in Washington, and Melinda Herring, Deputy Director of the Eurasia Center at the Atlantic Council, a think tank also based here in Washington. And both women join me via Microsoft Teams. Welcome to you both. Andrea Kendall-Taylor, let me begin with you. Where do we stand almost 1 month now into this horrific conflict, given Ukrainians' resistance? The Russian forces seem to be stalling. They're targeting civilian infrastructure, Putin's internal crackdown, and of course, the U.S., NATO, EU sanctions and defensive assistance.
Thanks, Carol, for having me back. And it's really hard to imagine that we're already over 3 weeks into this conflict. And I would say it's really remarkable the way that the Ukrainians have resisted Russian advances. If you remember back to the beginning of the crisis, the U.S. government had expectations that the Russians would be able to take Kiev within, 96 hours or so. And here we are 3 weeks later. And I think it's fair to say that, the Russian advance has largely stalled throughout most of the country. The Russians' plans, initially at the beginning involved getting to Kiev as quickly as possible, toppling the Zelensky government, installing their puppet and getting out. And it's abundantly clear, we've moved so far beyond that. And it is clear at this point that there really is no prospects for Russia to be able to accomplish its political objectives in Ukraine. That is clear. They cannot use their military in the way that Putin had expected. And so now the big question that everyone is asking is how this will end. There have been some signs. Negotiations are ongoing. The Ukrainians have expressed some kind of quiet optimism that at least the Russians are more serious in those negotiations. That's an open question. But the question I think on everyone's mind now is how does this end? As you noted, the Russians have shifted tactics. They are now brutally going after civilian centers in Ukrainian cities because I think that's Putin's play at this point. I think Putin wants out. I think he knows he cannot win this conflict. And so now he is doing exactly as you said, Carol, which is going after civilians to put maximum pressure, to break their spirit and put maximum pressure on President Zelensky to bend to the Russians' will in these negotiations. So I think that's where we are.
Turning to you, Melinda Herring, and welcome to the program. Where do you think we stand? Do you agree with Andrea Kendall Taylor that basically Putin knows he cannot really win? His political objectives are not attainable, so he has shifted these tactics. What is your take?
Hey, Carol, thanks for having me. I think Andrea nailed it. I'm not sure that Putin wants out, though. That's the one question I think that is an open question. So, you know, Andrea is more of a Russia Putinologist than I am, and I'd be curious to hear her take on this. But when I look back and think about Vladimir Putin, he's not the same guy he was at the end of 99 when he was installed. He's always been a risk taker, but he's been a careful risk taker. And the actions that he his gambles on February 24th is not the action of a careful risk taker. So there's a lot of speculation that he is sick. I don't know if that's true or not. The Brits seem to think he has Parkinson's. He's acting differently than he has in the past. Is his behavior consistent with the message that he put forth at the Munich Security Conference in 2007 when he said that the end of the Soviet Union was the greatest geopolitical tragedy of the 20th century? Yeah, it is. But he's never been this aggressive or taken the kind of risks. So I think COVID made him really weird. He was already paranoid to begin with, and he's increasingly isolated, and he has a very small circle of people around him to give him advice. So I'm not sure that he has decided that he wants out. Yes, it has not been easy. He expected to roll in a few days. And, you know, if Vladimir Putin had bothered to read a newspaper, he would have known that the Ukrainians were going to fight. The Rosenkopf Center in Kyiv, Ukraine, it's a good polling firm, found that 45% of Ukrainians would fight and resist. So I'm not surprised at all by the strength of the resistance. I think the big analytical error on our side as the nerd community, Andrea, is that we overestimated the strength of the Russian military and underestimated the strength of the Ukrainian forces. And, you know, I think we should admit to that. And there's some reasons why. So one is the Ukrainians are obviously fighting for their homeland. This is an existential struggle. They've also been doing this for 8 years. This is not Vladimir Putin's first rodeo in Ukraine. They know their territory and terrain better than the Russian side does. I think those are some of the factors. And, you know, there's low morale on the Russian side. There's a lot of anecdotal reporting that the Russian forces didn't know where they were going to be fighting. And they're sort of horrified when they realize that they're fighting their Slavic Ukrainian brothers. So I think these are some of the reasons. And then the Ukrainians have gotten really good, you know, over the last 8 years at fighting and resisting with lesser people and lesser equipment.
Well, all excellent points, Melinda Herring. So turning to you, Andrea Kendall Taylor, to pick up on what Melinda was talking about, and this polemic over the no-fly zone fits into this because NATO is saying, well, despite the request by Volodymyr Zelensky for a no-fly zone to protect the skies, to prevent the bombing, that it's dangerous because we're talking about two nuclear powers and a no-fly zone does implicate NATO in potentially shooting down Russian planes. And that gets to Vladimir Putin's state of mind, that he may not be 100% there and could resort perhaps to something like nuclear or chemical or biological weapons. What are your thoughts with regard to that?
Well, I think Melinda is absolutely right that Putin has evolved over time. As Melinda said, there are common threads that, you know, you pick up his speech in 2007 in Munich. And the other, I think, important thing here is the form of government that Putin presides over. So we have long known that this is a personalist authoritarian system, but we have seen that shift to an extreme form of personalism, which is incredibly unusual in this day and age. And so you can see, you know, Putin had a show with his national security team in which it was very clear that there is now no one around him who can contain him, constrain him. There's no one who can really present information to him that would be contrary to Putin's worldview. That puts us in a really dangerous place if, as Melinda suggested, he is sick or some of these other issues that I think are very real concerns. So I think the point, too, is that this is a highly personalized authoritarian regime. This really is up to the decision of one man. And really throughout history, that hasn't occurred very frequently. The other thing, though, that reminds me of or that to get to like his risk taking, his propensity, he's always been a risk taker. But there's another dynamic here, too. If you look at the academic literature on personalism, it's these highly personalist leaders, especially as they are committing heinous war crimes, who, if they are ousted from office, expect and know that they will be jailed, killed, exiled. I think it's top of mind for President Putin, the images of Gaddafi. There are rumors that he watched that video over and over. over of Gaddafi being drugged through the street. Saddam Hussein was hung in the public square. So these leaders in particular have a lot more to fight for. Very different than a leader who thinks they can retire comfortably in their dacha somewhere. I don't think that's what Putin thinks awaits him. And the more heinous and violent this gets, I think the more violently he is going to fight in Ukraine to avoid perceptions of him losing a war, and the more violently he will oppose dissent inside Russia. We're already moving in that direction, but I would expect that if you do see protesters, he is going to be willing to use all tools necessary in order to push back against his people as well. It puts us in a really dangerous place, and those are the calculations that people are having to make, the considerations you have to weigh when we're thinking about how we can support the Ukrainians and their ability to defend themselves without triggering even more horrible atrocities.
Melinda Herring, anything to add or subtract to what Andrea Kendall Taylor just said with regard to Putin and the fact that he's so isolated? Is there any scenario where somebody in his inner circle could try to stop him or?
Look, I think that's wishful thinking. Is there a possibility that there'll be a palace coup? Sure. You know, it's 1 in 100 chance. I would not put my money on it. I think another important factor, though, is this week Putin gave another insane, unglued speech. Fascist is probably the kindest term to describe it. He's not in a mood to negotiate. I know that the Russians and Ukrainians are negotiating and there is some optimism, but when you look at the terms that both sides are talking about, they're stuck and no one knows how to deal with Crimea and no one knows how to deal with the Donbass. And neither side is going to be willing to compromise. This is not going to be easy to come to a solution. And Putin, I think Andrea just explained it really well. He's at the end of his rope. This is a 21-year-old legacy. Vladimir Putin does have real achievements. He rebuilt Russia. He rebuilt the economy. Before what he did, he had strong macroeconomic stabilization, and he destroyed it, you know, with a really bad gamble on February 24th. But I don't think he's in a mood to negotiate.
You're listening to Encounter on The Voice of America. My guests are Andrea Kendall Taylor, Senior Fellow and Director of the Transatlantic Security Program at the Center for a New American Security, and Melinda Herring, from whom you just heard. She's Deputy Director of the Eurasia Center at the Atlantic Council. We're discussing the West's response to Russia's unprovoked invasion of Ukraine. And this is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel, VOA. Well, here's a shout out to a loyal Facebook fan, Zabeiru Awal from Zinder, Niger. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please send an email to encounter@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Back to you, Andrea Kendall Taylor, with respect to the West response, the sanctions. But I want to pick up very briefly on Melinda Herring's point about these so-called negotiations going on just as the bombs are falling on Ukraine. Somebody wrote that the talk of a potential ceasefire or even negotiations really means reload, you know, for Putin and for the military. It's just a pause. So how realistic or how optimistic are you at all about any of these negotiations?
I agree with Melinda that it's still not clear yet that Putin is ready to negotiate. And there may be some optimism from people around him, Lavrov and others, making some positive noises in that direction. But again, we know that only one man matters. It's Putin. And as Melinda said in his recent speech, those are not the words and the tone and the demeanor of someone who wants to negotiate. I do think, though, the longer this goes, the worse it gets for Putin. We do see signs inside Russia of pressure against him. You know, we're seeing rappers and prima ballerinas defecting, leaving the country. The Uzbeks just recently said that they oppose the war. So Putin, I think, is losing support. And I think he will be attuned to that and at least certainly paranoid that it is happening. And so I think the more pressure he feels domestically, the more he might be willing to at least lower some of his still very maximalist demands on Ukraine. I think we've also seen Putin lower his expectations in the sense that, you know, Putin had talked about regime change. I don't think he wants regime change anymore. I actually think now Putin needs Zelensky. He probably recognizes that Zelensky is the only leader who would have the legitimacy and credibility to sign some sort of deal with Russia. So I think Putin's demands are evolving and could likely continue to evolve as time goes on. And then on the Ukrainian side, we've seen Zelensky talk about neutrality. He has publicly said that he, you know, quote unquote, has cooled on the idea. So there's teeny bits of movement movement on both sides. But again, as Melinda said, the questions about territorial integrity are going to be key. Russia continues to demand that Ukraine recognize Russian control over Crimea and the independence of the regions in the Donbas. And that's where there really are going to be key sticking points, as the Ukrainians are saying they are unwilling to compromise on their territorial integrity. So I think the broad contours of some possible agreement are there, but the two sides are just too far apart. And so I think, you know, on the Russian side, it's just going to get dirtier and nastier as they are trying to put maximum pressure on Zelensky to get him to bend. And we'll have to see. I think until we get to a point where perhaps there's some sort of gridlock on the battlefield, or if President Putin feels enough pressure at home, I think those negotiations are still a long way away from bearing any real fruit.
Melinda Herring, how much stock do you put in these protests in Russia that we're seeing? They're taking great risks, those who are going out on the streets. Recently, the television producer who tried to interfere with a newscast saying, don't believe the propaganda. You know, this is a war that is being promulgated by Russia. With respect to any kind of internal protests that could somehow reach a crescendo. And what about, how do you see Zelensky's leadership and the resistance in Ukraine, as well as the West's support?
On Russia, don't get too excited. There's several thousand people who've come out. Andrea will have the latest number on how many people have been arrested. It was more than 6,000. We're not talking about regime change here. But I think that there may not be as many people on the streets as there have been in the past, but that the regime is more fragile than it was at previous periods. I think that's the interesting thing. There's no good polling right now. The Kremlin polling says that 70% of people support Putin. I think that's nonsense. I think it's closer to 50-50, but I don't have a good number. So as far as I can tell, 60% of Russians, this is good polling, before the 24th supported the independence of Crimea as Russian, and they supported the independence of the Donbas as joining Russia. That was a good, reputable polling firm, but that was before the 24th. So who knows? We know that there is a lot of dissent within Russia. I'm in my 40s. Young people my age in Russia are going to Istanbul. They're going to Yerevan. They're trying to leave. The word that my Russian friends keep using over and over again is North Korea. We don't want to live in a big North Korea. So it is isolated. You can't use your Visa card. You can't travel abroad, and you are basically the pariah of the world. Your country can no longer participate in any of the big sporting competitions, and you're banned from big artistic competitions as well. The joke last week was, so we're going to go back to driving Vladas, but the problem is some of the parts that go into Ladas are from Germany, so we can't even drive a damn Lada. You know, everyone is upset with what's happening there, but there's really no way to oppose it, and there's so few sources of information in Russia, so that's one. How has Zelensky done? Zelensky went from, I would say, being a mediocre peacetime president to a fabulous wartime leader. I think he went from a C to an A in American terms. Last year, he spent his entire year consolidating power through the National Security and Defense Council, fighting judicial reform and fighting anti-corruption reform. So he was pretty bad last year, but he has shown his physical courage, and he's not a big guy. He's about 5'6" tall. So he's slight, and he did not have to stay in Kyiv. He knows he's a sitting duck. He knows his family are targets as well. He's got a wonderful wife who is so apolitical and does not like politics and does not want to be in the limelight, and two small children. So I think he has the admiration of the world. And I think he's inspired the world with his physical courage, but also with his rhetoric. So he was a comedian for many, many years, and this is where he really shines. And so this week, when he spoke to Congress, he used references that speak to the hearts of Americans. Brilliant PR move. So I would say that Zelensky gets high marks. Even if he dies, he's going to go down in Ukrainian history as the greatest Ukrainian president because he saved the country.
It's really remarkable. A Jewish Ukrainian, and all are rallying around him. And Putin is calling Ukrainians, you know, neo-Nazis. It's all, you know, rather bizarre.
But I think that Ukraine has fundamentally changed. So Ukraine really changed in 2014. Andrea is shaking her head. She knows this just as well as I do. But there's a new civic identity that formed. It doesn't matter if you're Jewish, Crimean Tatar, Ukrainian, or Russian. You are Ukrainian first. Your language, your religion, your ethnicity doesn't matter as much as it did in the past. Those old cleavages are still present, but they're less pronounced. And that started in 2014. And it's much more true now.
Back to you, Andrea Kendall Taylor. Quickly, how would you assess the West's response, the sanctions regime, the sending of defensive weapons, NATO's unity, the embargo on, at least by the United States, on Russian oil and gas, etc., the removal of most favored nation status. Is this an effective strategy?
I would say, you know, if we step back and think about where we were before Russia invaded, where we are today is nowhere short of remarkable. And there has been such a sea change in international perceptions of Putin and about what needs to be done to confront him. I think Germany is the poster child for that, seeing their entire kind of foreign policy, national security doctrine shift just in a matter of days, now being willing to send weapons into a war zone, et cetera. So I think it's really tremendous where we are. The unity has been remarkable, that we have been able to move so quickly and in unison with allies and partners. This is the most punishing economic sanctions regime we've seen in history. We moved much further than anything I expected. We went straight to SWIFT. The United States has now done oil and gas, the sanctions on Russia's central bank. We talk about how Putin has miscalculated. They obviously underestimated the international response. I think we all likely did. But even they have gone through an exercise trying to figure out how to sanctions proof their regime. And I don't think in a million years they expected that the United States would be willing and the Europeans would be willing to go after the central bank. So this surprise has certainly shocked the Kremlin. We have seen the United States, the EU, and other European countries continue to send arms to the Ukrainians to help them defend themselves. Lots of people could debate, should we do more on the no-fly zone or sending the MiG-29s? But really, the amount of military aid and assistance that has been flowing into Ukraine, I do think is remarkable. We are considering what else we can do short of the no-fly zone, thinking of S-300s and other kind of air defense that we can give the Ukrainians. Also, the private sector. The private sector response has been far more significant, with over 200 oil and gas companies, Starbucks, McDonald's. I mean, all of these things have, in very short order, entirely cut business ties inside Russia. So I think it has been a very remarkable, robust, and cohesive response.
Melinda, a remarkable and robust, cohesive response by the West. What is your take and what more could be done, do you think?
Andrea's right that it's remarkable how far the West has gone. I wouldn't quibble with anything she said. Where I would quibble is with three items where we should be doing more. Number one is the MiGs. These are Soviet-era jets. There's about 30 of them that are in Poland, and the Poles want to give them to the Ukrainians. And the Ukrainians have said, please send us fighter jets. We know how to fly these. So the jets were supposed to be sent from Poland to a U.S. Air Force base in Germany, and then the Americans would transport them to Ukraine. That deal got complicated and the Biden administration freaked out. And they made a really dumb choice. This should have all been cooked behind the scenes. It should have not been made public. It looks really bad. And it looks like we don't have the Ukrainians back. And it makes us look weak in front of Putin. But I have a couple of Air Force and military fellows here. And they've said repeatedly, yes, that it should have been done. The Pentagon is wrong. But my military fellows have said, don't obsess about the MiGs. There are weapon systems that we can send that are much more important. And Biden did that yesterday. So I'm giving him a better grade today than I would have earlier this week. Where I do have a real problem with the Biden administration is with visas and refugees. The White House has not changed its visa policy or its refugee policy. It takes 9 months for a person to get a visa in Warsaw, Poland, to come to the United States. And hundreds of Americans would be so glad to take Ukrainians in. So I see inconsistency in that policy. And I also think that we are not creative enough with the no-fly zone. I understand there's a risk of escalation. I'm not going to argue for a full-scale no-fly zone, but a limited fly zone is something that we should consider. And I think we have to keep pointing out it's not the Americans or the West that's escalating. It is Vladimir Putin that is escalating. But a no-fly zone with a very limited area of the country where the Russian Air Force is not based for humanitarian reasons makes a lot of sense right now. So I would urge the administration to be bold, creative, and courageous because human life depends on it, and we can't look away from this.
A very quick last question. The role of China, Andrea Kendall-Taylor. Is Xi Jinping bound at the hip with his fellow autocrat?
It is a very good question because I think it's not clear cut. For a dictator like Xi, who has a very strong personal rapport with his best and bosom buddy, Mr. Putin, he is intent on keeping him in power. For China, Russia is one of their most strategic partners in their shared opposition to the United States. And he will do, I think, where possible, out of the limelight, whatever he can in order to prop up Putin at home. They are not going to make a big stand about circumventing or evading sanctions. I would be extremely surprised if they sent military aid to Russia. They are going to say all of the right things, in part because they want to keep the Europeans on board. You know, I think they'll take a page out of the Putin playbook, which is say all the right things internationally. We're not going to attack Ukraine. We would like to negotiate and then go ahead and turn around and do exactly the opposite. I mean, I think that's what we should expect of the Chinese. Chinese.
You get the last word on China, Melinda Herring.
I've got nothing else to add. That was perfect.
Ladies, I'm afraid on that note, then, that is all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my terrific guests, Andrea Kendall Taylor, Senior Fellow and Director of the Transatlantic Security Program at the Center for a New American Security, and Melinda Herring, Deputy Director of the Eurasia Center at the Atlantic Council. Encounter was produced in Washington with technical assistance from Rick Pantaleo. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.